standing at the station and I'm waiting on my train to come. Well, I'm standing at the station and I'm waiting on my train to come. I can't stand around all day, you know I gotta run.
Hello, I'm Todd DeFeo, publisher and editor of railfanning.org. I had the opportunity to speak with author Edward Siegel, whose new book highlights the history of campaign trains. Siegel has compiled a fascinating narrative giving insight into one of the more overlooked aspects of railroad and political history, how the campaigns traveled. Most students of history are familiar with the notion of whistle-stop campaigns, but many people might not be familiar with just how many candidates have traveled by train, or that they continue to hit the rails for their campaigns. But more than scratching the surface of well-known train-loving candidates, Siegel's extensive research resulted in intriguing and unexpected anecdotes and stories showing just how ingrained railroads are in our political and American cultures. I hope you enjoy this conversation.
Well, thank you for taking time to chat with us today. Just love to hear a little bit more about yourself and also how you became interested in campaign trains and their history.
Well, I got started, Todd, when I actually had the opportunity to organize a campaign train tour for a member of Congress. We had a 104-mile tour, four stops in Oklahoma. And as I was doing research and organizing for the event, I really could not find a lot of information about the history of campaign trains. There are bits and pieces, but I could not find a whole book or detailed articles about the history of campaign trains. And so that became my mission, my obsession, and eventually this book on the history of campaign trains in American politics, and also how a lot of people in the commercial fields and non-political areas have actually mimicked campaign trains for their own purposes.
It's really interesting that there hadn't been a lot of research into it. What time frame did you start looking at? And does your book cover, does it go all the way back to the beginning, or is there an area that it focuses on?
Well, that was an interesting part of my research. I had thought that campaign trains were, you know, started at, about the time of Harry Truman when he did his famous cross-country underdog campaign in 1948. But that's the value of research. Sometimes you find things you're not expecting. And my research actually found that the first campaign train was conducted by William Henry Harrison in 1836. And it wasn't until the 1850s that the train started to come back a little bit when Stephen Douglas and Abraham Lincoln campaigned by train when they were running for Senate in Illinois. And then the research took me all the way up to 2020 when President Joe Biden campaigned by train in Pennsylvania, and in 2022 when a Senate candidate campaigned by train in his winning campaign for election. So the campaign trains are nothing new. They stretch back more than 185 years, and it's just not been a couple or a dozen or so politicians that have campaigned by train. It's been more than 200 that I document in my book.
I will readily admit I would not have picked William Henry Harrison to be the first president to campaign by a train.
No, that was a surprise indeed.
Which may need your second biggest surprise then, because one of the questions I wanted to ask was, what was the biggest surprise that you learned in researching? So if it needs to be the second biggest surprise, that'll work too.
The biggest surprise was the number of accidents or near accidents that happened to candidates when they were campaigning by train. Charles Evan Hughes, when he ran for president in 1916, he was almost run over by his own campaign train when his car got stuck on the tracks and his campaign train was coming around the corner and almost ran into the car that he and his wife were sitting on. Cox, when he was running for president with the FDR in 1920, his train derailed in Arizona. But perhaps the most famous and campaign train accident happened in 1944 in Castle Rock, Washington, when the presidential candidate for that year, Wilkie, his train actually ran into another train that had stalled on the tracks. And no one was killed, but a lot of people were injured and hurt. And I actually met one of the reporters from the Associated Press who was on that train, who wrote about the accident. And he later shared with me a group family photo that Wilkie and other members of the campaign trained staff and reporters, they took a family portrait in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And as I don't know if it was a joke or not, but they established what they called the Castle Rock Survivors Association to document the train wreck and how they were able to survive that accident.
Maybe the obvious joke we should make here is that it's not just the voters that you need to look out for while campaigning via train.
That's right. Although there, some voters were almost injured or killed by campaign trains. A famous accident, near accident, happened in Silver Spring, Maryland, when Adlai Stevenson's train backed up and almost ran over dozens of people who had come to see the train. Ironically, Stevenson was not on the train. A surrogate was on the train, William Fulbright, and because the candidate was not on his own campaign train, the reporters dubbed the train the Ghost Train. But that was another famous accident that was documented and got plenty of press coverage at the time.
That's fascinating. It's interesting that it's still campaigning by train still happens today. I'm not sure that's something a lot of voters would necessarily think of or realize even happens. We tend to see the images of presidents and candidates getting on planes and traveling by other means. Do you think a lot of people realize that campaigning by train is still a part of the landscape today?
No, and frankly, that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. I wanted to help educate people about this forgotten aspect of American history. Indeed, every generation of voters that passes away, the new generation has less of a knowledge or even awareness of campaign trains. One of the myths I came across in my research was a lot of people assume that the heyday of campaign trains were in the 30s and the 40s and maybe the 50s. But actually, according to my research, there have been dozens of campaign trains since then. The difference is that the campaign trains in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, they tended to be much longer in terms of how long they were campaigning around the country. Not a matter of days, but sometimes weeks at a time, they would travel from one part of the country to the other. In the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, there have actually been more trains than ever before, but those trains have been a lot shorter in duration, lasting a few days, maybe even a few hours, depending upon where the train was traveling. So that's one of the things I write about in my book, the number of times that there have been premature obituaries written about campaign trains. They are certainly alive and well on the campaign train trail. And I hope to educate people about those stories and share with them what I learned about this fascinating and largely forgotten part of American political history.
In addition to how trains have changed, how has the campaign train changed? Is it not just, you know, motive power necessarily, but has the what goes on in the campaign trains and the makeup of them, has it changed? And you mentioned a little bit about it. You know, they used to run longer distances and today they might be shorter. But I'm just curious how the makeup of the train has changed over the years.
Well, trains have actually gotten shorter. In the 40s and 50s, the trains were anywhere from 15 to 18 car lengths long, and they took up a lot of space. They carried sometimes hundreds of people, reporters, staff, and VIPs. More recently, the trains have been shorter in length, maybe two or three or four cars at the most. That was the case when I organized a campaign train in Oklahoma. We had two locomotives that we had rented from Santa Fe Railway, and then we had a passenger car and a caboose. And ironically, the caboose that we used on our train was actually used by Dwight Eisenhower when he was campaigning for president in 1952. Campaign trains, though, have changed in terms of the technology, and the candidates and their staff, they usually do a pretty good job of keeping up with the technology to put the latest technology on the trains. It was Abraham Lincoln who actually had a telegraph machine on his train on the way to Washington when he was on his way to be inaugurated. And as other technology became available, such as telephones, mimeograph machines, movie cameras, copying machines, whatever it is, it had a habit of being included in campaign trains when it became affordable and practical to do so.
Well, it's really interesting just to see how the technology has kept up. The technology on the train matches the technology out in the world, I guess is maybe the better way to say that.
In fact, in 1984, when President Reagan campaigned by train in central Ohio, he actually traveled on the same train that Harry Truman and FDR had used, the Ferdinand Magellan. But the technology had advanced so far then that President Reagan actually called the crews of one of the space shuttle missions that was traveling 200 miles over his head. And there was a lot of press coverage about how he talked to the space crews from a train.
It's interesting considering when we think of Air Force One as an example, you don't really think twice about the president making a call like that. But for some reason, I guess when it's on a train, we think of the technology not matching the train, perhaps.
Well, it's funny you mention Air Force One, because for many years, the Ferdinand Magellan was a special car that that has been referred to as the Air Force One of its day. It was built by converting a Pullman railroad car in the 1940s. The U.S. government paid, I believe it was $10 for the car, and it was outfitted with the latest technology, the latest security provisions to make the car as safe as possible for presidents to travel on it. In fact, it was built to be incredibly heavy, so that if it ever sank in a lake, it would sink standing up, and it would not topple over. And they had built in special submarine-like hatches that if the car did sink, it was their escape route to escape the car and get back to the surface.
A little more cost-effective than Air Force One might cost today, perhaps, if we looked at the numbers a little deeper.
Well, I'd have to do the math, but that car was worth about $250,000 in the 1940s, and I'm sure it would cost millions of dollars to build or to convert now. So, on all things considered, the Air Force One today is quite a deal.
Fair enough. How did reporters have any interesting reactions to being on the trains, aside from maybe some of those near accidents? Didn't know if they, in your research, you had found specific anecdotes or stories from the reporters themselves and how they felt about traveling by train.
Yeah, some reporters really hated it because it was so draining. One reporter described it, traveling on a train, as one of the hardest jobs in all of journalism because they had to be working almost 24/7. Following the candidates, writing stories. If they were writing for morning and afternoon papers at that time, they were writing and reporting almost around the clock. One reporter described it as a high-level loafing, where in between stops you had the chance to relax and take care of personal matters, but you were never sure when the train was going to stop and the candidate was going to speak. Many candidates would follow a very rigorous schedule of when they would speak and who they would speak and where the train would stop. And other candidates would stop if there was just a few people gathered at the side of the tracks just to listen to them speak. Harry Truman said he would have his train stop no matter how large or how small the crowd would be. And sometimes his train would stop for just a handful of people. Franklin Roosevelt had the same attitude. And sometimes his train would stop for five or six people who were waiting on the side, hoping just to wave, never expecting that the train would stop and the President of the United States would take the time to talk to them.
It's really neat. It's a great way to see parts of the country today that sometimes we might think are a little bit inaccessible as well. But that's really fascinating to hear about their interactions with people in many of these communities. One of the things I think is interesting as well, we tend to think a lot about the president traveling by train, but you've mentioned congressional members as well, members of Congress that travel a lot by train. Is that something that was surprising to you, or do you think a lot of people realize that it's not just the president who might be campaigning via train?
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting aspect of the research. If there were serviceable tracks, if there was ability to rent a train, and if they had enough people who they thought would come out and see them at the depots, then yes, congressional candidates would certainly use the train. Candidates for governor would also use the train. And Sometimes these trips, of course, depending upon the congressional district, they were incredibly short, just a few towns. I identified, I think it was five or six or so trains that campaign trains actually ran in Vermont over the years. And they would just go through, a handful of towns, as opposed to California, where Senate candidates would travel by train. And they would often go stop by several towns in the Central Valley of California to meet with people who would come out there. Of course, there were also people who would run for mayor, would you believe, who actually was able to use a campaign train in their district or running for a county commissioner or other local offices. So if the candidate really wanted to reach people that they could not ordinarily reach by other means or add a personal touch to their campaigning, then a campaigning by train sure made a lot of sense for them.
Never would have guessed a mayor would be campaigning by train, but I guess there's no reason they couldn't.
No, it's a long list of people running for state, local, or national office that have taken advantage of campaign trains to meet with people, to connect with people. Whether it's the largest cities at the times or the smallest communities, it was and continues to be, under the right circumstances, a great way to connect with voters.
And you mentioned a little bit about the geography. Was it concentrated in a particular part of the country where politicians use trains, or was it really all across the country?
It was really all across the country. It wasn't the geography that was a deciding factor. It's where the people were. Sometimes it made sense to go to the largest cities, such as Los Angeles or Chicago or New York. Other times they would just go to these white spaces in the road, essentially. If they had a train depot, they would stop. But if they saw some people gathered on the side of the truck tracks up ahead, the engineer would have had instructions that, to stop the train. So it was really not a matter of geography, but where the people were and the best way to reach them, whether it was at depots, at scheduled rallies, or impromptu stops along the way.
I'm really struck by that because I keep going back to the plane, which is not the only way people travel these days, and politicians travel, certainly they drive quite often, but it's the ability to have those almost off-the-cuff type of interactions with voters that I think we don't necessarily think about happening today. I'm sure it still happens to some degree, but I feel like we don't necessarily think about it as much as people just seeing some people who might want to interact with the president or the mayor, or whoever's campaigning for whatever office it might be, and they can just change their schedule as time permits.
Yeah, there's a lot less spontaneity today, and of course, security precautions involved in presidential and other campaigns than there was on the campaign trail when trains were not only traditional, but they were expected. And sometimes people were actually disappointed if candidates would not stop. The story is told about Theodore Roosevelt. When he was campaigning for president, his train was going through Texas on the way to take him to a reunion of the Rough Riders. And when a small town called Temple learned that his train was not going to stop, the city council actually passed an emergency legislation to require that all campaign trains traveling through the regions must, as a matter of law, stop at their town, and the candidate or the politician must speak to their people. Originally, the legislation was going to actually require the trains to stop for 10 minutes, but as a compromise, they said they only have to stop for 5 minutes. And so Teddy Roosevelt did stop. And then years later, Harry Truman, when he was running for president, his train stopped, but he made it a point of telling people that he knew about the local law, but he didn't need a law to stop and talk to the people. And that got a good response from the crowd that came out to see him.
He's got some good messaging there as a politician. He knows exactly what to say that'll get the crowd on his side.
Yes, but of course, some politicians, they got so tired with campaigning. There was a couple instances that I talk in my book, how the candidates would thank the good people of, state X and Y, when in fact they were in a different state and he didn't know he was talking to. So that was another challenge for some politicians to stay alert, to stay focused, and to pay attention to where they were and to make sure they were saying the right things to the right people at the right time along their campaign train route.
I guess we could say that's still a challenge today for some politicians at times.
Yes.
And did the railroads have any perspective on campaign trains? I'm just thinking about, it might be hard today to just pull up to a town and stop without disrupting traffic. I don't know if railroads ever weighed in on if they had a pro or con perspective on it, or liked them or disliked them.
Well, actually, there's a story from 1966 that I talk about in my book, when Pat Brown was running for re-election for governor of California. His train actually stopped at an intersection in Inglewood, California, and a police officer actually gave a traffic ticket, a citation to the engineer of the train for blocking traffic where the train had stopped. But more people then, in the heydays of the campaign train in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, they knew where their train stations were because it was often a part of their central part of the town or the city. And many people at the time didn't even know, or perhaps there was not even an airport for politicians to visit. But that's another way that the campaign trains have changed with the times, where the trains sometimes, especially today, are less regarded as an essential part of campaigning and more of eye candy, as a photo op, as a great way to help attract attention to the media. And I came across more great stories in my research and photos, newspaper and magazine and television accounts of the colorful way the campaigns were positioned by the media. They were certainly great photo ops, and they made a great reason for the press to come out and talk to them. And that's another reason why I think it's important for politicians to consider campaigning by train today, if they have tracks that are serviceable, if they can rent or use a train, and if the population is distributed in such a way that it would make sense for people to come out. Of course, one of the things I learned is that organization is an important part of successful campaign trains. You just can't say, you know, we're going to stop at the station. Often candidates and their staff would spend weeks or months to publicize the arrival. Sometimes the schedule of the trains were front page news in local newspapers. And so people would know when and where a candidate would be campaigning. So it's a matter of organizing, it's a matter of publicity, and getting the word out to help ensure a successful campaign train, whether it's at a train depot or just a trackside rally someplace.
You have any predictions on the future of campaign trains? Do you think they are here to stay for the foreseeable future, and that politicians of today and tomorrow will continue to use them?
Politicians and their staff are always looking for ways of getting attention from the media. And I think if it makes sense, then yes, campaign trains are here to stay. Certainly not in the way that they had been in decades past, but it's a great way to get attention still, a great way to help connect with people still, and a great way to connect with as many voters as possible, whether they come out and see you at the train station or read about the train visit in social media or the mainstream media. So it's a great way to campaign still, if it makes sense to do so.
This is a fascinating topic, and I really appreciate your taking time to chat with us. Any additional anecdotes that particularly stuck out as you were doing your research?
Well, the other part of the story is the different kinds of gifts that candidates would receive when they campaigned by train, or the kind of greetings they would get. In 1908, when William Howard Taft was campaigning, he made a stop in a small town in Minnesota, and a woman actually came up to the train on the back of an elephant. And I have a picture of that in the book. Other candidates were greeted by cowboys, you know, riding their horses, dressed up in their flaps and 10-gallon hats. People would show up, especially for Democrats. They would be greeted by someone riding or bringing a donkey along. Of course, a donkey is a symbol of the Democratic Party. Other candidates were given gifts of badgers or goats or other kind of animals. And food was a very popular gift, whether it's dates or raisins, local fruit, peanut butter, you name it. candidates would often be met by greeting by their welcoming committees or supporting voters and greeted them with these kind of gifts. So that was another part of the campaign train story I was not expecting.
Where can folks go to learn more about your book and buy a copy of it?
Well, I encourage them to visit my website at whistlestoppolitics.com. That's whistlestoppolitics.com. There's a book trailer there to promote the book. There's also a rotating slideshow of images from campaign trains from the 1900s. And also there's a link to pre-order the book. The book is now available for pre-order as an ebook on Amazon. And in a few weeks, it'll be available for pre-order for hardcover. And the hardcover edition and an ebook will be launched in January. And later in the year, there'll also be an audiobook. So I urge people to learn more about campaign trains in my book at whistlestoppolitics.com and to pre-order the ebook edition today.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation. For railfanning.org, I'm Todd DeFeo. Be sure to visit railfanning.org for more news, features, and photos from the rails.